explaining, you asked me, and then I got to do an intro on here to let, you know, talk about the date and where we are and things like that. But you had just finished telling me, you asked me about how did I run into Frank Nesseth, and that you were on Crookston with him.
Yeah, I'm on Crookston.
Uh-huh.
He's from Richfield.
Right.
And
right.
Then by then, the years went by, and after the war, I wasn't going to play anymore. I came back from the war, and I went back to med school, and I wasn't going to play anymore. And then I got a call from Ruby Fleckenstein from Fairborn. How would you like to pitch for Fairborn this other minute?
Yeah.
So by darn gum, I was in med school, and I had to watch the when at the beginning of the season, I had to take a re-entry exam into med school. And I knew something was wrong, because when I was being separated from my destroyer duty, 4 years of destroyer during World War II, they kept me for about 10 days, and every day a new bunch of hunchos came to listen to my chest. And then once, the last one that came, I asked him, well, what the hell is going on here? Well, you've got a funny, sounding heart. You can't be alive. But, so we'll get the chief from the Chicago Medical School to come over tomorrow. He checked me out, he listened to my chest, and he said, yeah, you've got grade 4, grade 5 systolic murmurs, and your heart is irregular, but you look so good. He says, something is not right here. So when I came, so they discharged me. And when I came back to the U, I started again where I left off. Before the war began, I was with Moline in the 3ID.
Right.
When the war broke out.
Yeah.
And I knew I wasn't going to make it. And so, luckily, a fellow by the name of Eugene McCahill, who hired me to pitch for Lake City in 1937, after I pitched a game against the Gophers, an exhibition game, the year, and I had a real good day.
Mm.
And right after the game, McFellow came to the mound. I had three scouts come to the mound and they wanted me to sign up and they were going to find me out. McHale said, how would you like to pitch for Lake City? And he sounded like such an honest fellow.
Huh?
And he said, I'll give you a boarded room down there and you will be the boss. You will manage and coach the Lake City baseball club. And I took him on. Oh man, I took Gene McHale on. And so when the St. John's and the Minnesota College Conference baseball season ended, I went to Minneapolis. We had agreed with McHale. He gave me a brand new Cadillac to drive down to Lake City. And he said, you can keep that car until the season ends.
Mm.
I said, well, Mr. McHale, I have never driven a car. Well, I can't.
No kidding.
So he had somebody, he called somebody, and he says, take Lefty in the Cadillac and point him towards Lake City. Put him on Highway 10, I think it was.
Okay.
And so he hired this fellow, so he put me on Highway 10, and he said, Hastings will be the first big town there.
Mm-hmm.
But stay on 10.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
If you've never driven before, don't go over 50 or 20 miles an hour. So I'm sweating like everything. But I got to Lake City by
mm-hmm.
them. And then when I got down there, McHale told me to park on the street and Huddle's Butcher Shop will be expecting me. So there was a butcher shop, and so then I was hired to pitch, coach, and manage the Lake City team. And
mm.
also I took care of the playground. I had about 80 kids in the recreational playground.
Oh, wow.
And after the, the season ended in Lake City, McHale was highly pleased.
I'll bet.
Yeah, he was highly pleased at the people. They gave me this watch. I treasured this watch. played the
Holy moly.
You were a 3 or 4 kid that was just a song.
Oh my gosh.
But that's anyway,
oh, that is sweet.
And it still works. It's still in good shape.
Oh, what a beauty. And the chain goes with it? They brought you the chain too?
What's that?
The chain came with it?
Everything went with it, yeah.
It says Ernest Sawada, 1937, in memory of Lake City.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. And also, I got, oh God, I got all kinds of stockings and shirts and whatnot from the townspeople. We had a real good season on
there. Oh, man.
And we won the championship down there.
Oh, no, but I want to just stop you a minute because, let's see, number one, I'm thinking we have two things we're dealing with here. We're fighting the sound of the air conditioner.
Oh, that's...
No, we don't want to do that. But I just want to bring this closer because I know from experience when I sit down to listen and make a transcript of the tape, it's hard if I can't hear you really clearly. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to move these books... I'm going to just put these right down here for you, and I'll put them back when I'm done. I'm just going to move the chair over. No. You don't have to do that. Yeah, but we don't want to boil you. I think I'll put these up for a little, like that. Then that'll receive your voice a little bit better. I don't think that's going to fall down to you.
No, fine.
But I don't want to stop your flow because it's good for you just to get going, and I want you to talk about anything you want to because one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
And that's the way I like to do an interview, just to let you do what you need to do. But when we first started, you asked me how I'd bumped into Frank Nesseth, and then you had started to talk about some other things about getting called up, and I don't want to miss that. We missed that on the tape. So could you take us back to when you first met Frank Nesseth and how you knew him?
Oh.
Because for the record of the tape, it is, what day is it today? It's Thursday, August 8th, or is it the 8th today?
Today is August 8th, yeah.
August 8th, and we're at the home of Dr. Ernest Sawada. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah.
Sawada,
yeah.
Okay, in Wayzata, Minnesota. And we're interviewing Dr. Sawada today because Dr. Sawada had quite a career playing for Crookston and Duluth in the Northern League. And for Moline in the Triple I League, the 3I League. And he pitched a couple of games for the Minneapolis Millers in 1940, which is my main interest, is because I'm the American Association guy. And so we want to find out more about Dr. Sawada today, and we want to find out about Dr. Sawada, the person and the ball player. So we want to take you back to first ball. How did you first run into Frank Nesseth, who I just interviewed in Grove City 2 weeks ago?
Frank Nesseth was from Litchfield, and I was pitched. Mike Kelly was the owner of the Minneapolis Millers. I was, after I graduated from St. John's, Father Dunston, my baseball coach at St. John's, took me over to the Minneapolis ball clubhouse. Over the phone, I had already agreed with Mike Kelly that I would like to really be given a chance.
Okay.
And so Reverend Dunston, with his priestly guard, took me into the clubhouse just before game time.
And this is at Collegeville, Minnesota?
This was at the Minneapolis ballpark.
Oh, this is at Nicolette.
Nicolette ballpark.
Yeah.
They were getting ready for the game when I got there, when Father Dunston took me over there. And there was... Tom Sheehan was the manager, and Otto Denning was the catcher, and Chief Hodson was one of the pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Pauscher and Smythe were two pitchers. And anyway, Father Dunston introduced me to everybody. And he said, be good to Lefty. He hasn't been around the block yet.
And for the sake of people who don't know who Lefty is, you're Lefty.
I'm Lefty, yeah. And so Chief Hodson... I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was a pitcher on the Minneapolis ball club.
I've read about him.
Tom Sheehan was the manager. And Otto Denning was the catcher. And I stayed with them. I stayed with the Minneapolis Millers as a rookie, but I never pitched that year on a regular basis.
And which year was that?
19. It must have been about 1939, I think, or 38 or 39 thereabouts.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I pitched batting practice every stinking day. And every stinking day, June, July, and then about middle of July or closer to August, I told the manager, Tom Sheehan, that I would like to face competition now. So they sent me out to Crookston in the Northern League.
Sure.
Before that, I had been with the Duluth Dukes for one or 2 years. But they sent me out to Crookston, and Mike Kelly was the owner of the Minneapolis Ball Club. There was nothing in writing, but he told me, Crookston is in last place in the Northern League. You've got 4 or 5 weeks now of the season is left. Win half of your ball games, and I'll give you a $5,000 bonus. And so I went up to Crookston, and with that kind of a motivation, I ended up with 6 wins and 2 losses in 4 weeks. Anytime any pitcher didn't want to pitch, I'll pitch. And the manager would say, Lefty, yeah, you could pitch every day. He says, you don't throw hard enough to get a sore arm. And but Tom Sheehan told me, the manager of the Crookston team, manager of Minneapolis
Millers.
He said, Lefty, you got the best goddamn palm ball that anybody ever had. Waste your fastball. Just keep it on the corners, outside and inside. And make a hit that dead fish of yours. And it really worked. And so my first game was against Jamestown. And Wally Gilbert was playing third base for, the team I was with. Wally Gilbert was a former Brooklyn Dodger player. He told me, Lefty, he said, I'll tell you how to pitch this fellow. He knew. He sized me up immediately. He said, you got a good changeup. Make him hit the dead fish and waste your fastball. And it really worked. Cal Lehman was right fielder for Jamestown, and he was hitting at that time 465. He never touched me. Everyone was a dribbler to first or second, but thanks to Wally Gilbert, he told me how to pitch. Make him hit that dead fish of yours.
Now, Wally Gilbert was the catcher?
He was the third baseman.
Third baseman, okay.
Yeah, the catcher was something else. I asked him for the signal. 1 for a single and 2 for a double. A fellow by the name of Johnny Plate, that's all he told me.
And his name was what?
Johnny Plate.
Johnny Plate.
Johnny Plate, yeah. His full name was Platowski. He came from Milwaukee someday.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll have to look him up.
But anyway, he was probably dead now, I don't know. But anyway, he did. Lefty, he said, they will hit you, and they'll hit a home run off of you. Never mind, just ask for another ball. Well, I figured, this is what professional ball is all about, But anyway, I finished the season, and at the end of the season, Minneapolis called me back, but I never pitched in any regular game that time. They called me back, and I pitched batting practice. But then later on, I don't know what year that it was, they asked me to go spring training. I went spring training with the Millers twice.
And where was this held, the spring training?
Daytona Beach.
Okay, it was down there.
Daytona Beach. And Mike Kelly says, he just didn't have room for me, but he told me he'd have to farm me out again. So I went, I don't know where the hell I went then. Was I with Duluth or Crookston next? I think it was Crookston. I went to Crookston, and yeah, I had a fairly good season there. With Crookston, I don't know if you knew Bill Barnacle or Bill Butlin.
Barnacle, definitely. He was a long time Minneapolis ball player, wasn't he?
Third base, yeah. Very good ball player. And anyway, the 1939, I was with Crookston. I think it was my second year there when it was obvious that there was going to be a war. They were going to be involved in World War II. And my friend from Lake City, Mikhail, Eugene Mikhail, told me, Lefty, you don't belong in the Army. I think you better think about getting into the Navy. Well, another year then evolved, and I was with Moline in the Three I League. Mike Kelly saying, find me out to Moline.
And this was the Moline who?
Moline Plows.
The Plows?
Moline Plows in the Three I League.
Wow.
And I pitched there all summer. And but we had a very poor team. We didn't win very many ball games. And there was Maury, Joe Maury was our manager. And I was from Crookston, and Mike Scullin. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
I know that I've seen it on the sheet. He was like the winningest pitcher on that team, lowest ERA, I believe, on that team.
On the
Moline team.
Moline team. And he was a good pitcher, but nobody won any ball game. We had. I tell you what kind of a ball club Moline was. The same kind of a ball club that the one I was first farmed out to. They farmed me out to Duluth. And there was a fellow by the name of Buzz Gray met me in the lobby of the Metropole Hotel. And he pitched for Hamlin when I pitched for St. John. He says, Lefty, you're on a horseshit ball club.
I believe that.
And, he warned me. And Blix Donnelly met me in the lobby. Lefty, you'll find out that this isn't college ball, you little left-handed son of a bitch. And they'll be hitting you, but you don't, never mind. And he and I were the same height. He was 5'8", and I was 5'8". And he and I weighed the same. But he told me, Letty, he says, I'm going to make the big leagues. I don't know what your ambitions are, but I'm going to make the big leagues, he said. And a long leap forward. I was the chief engineering officer on a destroyer in the Mediterranean towards the end of World War II when the World Series were on. So I asked the captain if I could listen to the World Series. I just about died when I turned the switch on. Blix Donnelly is the starting pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals. Holy balls, my roommate. And so...
Your roommate was with Moline, correct?
The roommate was...
With Duluth, okay.
With Duluth. And...
Blix Donnelly.
Blix Donnelly.
You're on the ship in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And which was the ship now?
That one was the USS Hanson.
Okay.
The first one I was on was the USS Jewett.
Right. We talked a little bit about the Jewett. And where exactly in the Mediterranean was the Hanson?
We had just finished covering the invasion of southern France. This was early September. Well, yeah, baseball season was ending. And we were involved in the invasion of D-Day. We covered Omaha Beach.
And so this was 41?
What was D-Day? 41 or 42? I think 41.
I'm thinking 41.
June of 41 or was it 42? I don't remember. But I turned on the radio. This was when we were in, after D-Day was over, and we then were shunted down into the Mediterranean to cover the invasion of southern France. That's when I turned on the stinking radio and hear Blix Donnelly was pitching for the St. Louis Cardinals. I could have died. Holy smokes, I could have died. And so he pitched the game and he won the last game of the World Series. Blix Donnelly did. The 5'8" roommate of mine from Olivia, Minnesota.
Yeah, that's right, Olivia. Uh-huh. You mentioned
and
that.
And
yep.
He won the game. And next year, at the end, we had to come back to States for some ship repairs. And we were put into Boston Harbor. And they had the ship repairs, and we had suffered some damage and whatnot. But anyway, this was spring again. The St. Louis Cardinals were playing at Boston. Hot damn. I picked up the phone and I called the clubhouse and Blix Donnelly answered the phone. And he recognized my voice. You little left-hander. Where in the hell are you? Come over here. And so the captain and the exec and I went to the ball game. They gave us prime seats and Blix Donnelly was in the bullpen. He didn't pitch that game. But Like my captain and the exec were really impressed. I'll tell you.
I can believe that. Who was the Cardinals manager at that time? That's right. I can look that up.
I don't know who was the manager.
I'm trying to think of anyone else who I could recognize who might be on that team.
Lick Donley, bang down. And after the game was over, we had him aboard ship, you know.
Oh,
God, the captain thought that was great. You know?
Oh, my, oh, my. Now, you, when you were on the Hanson and you found out that the radio was going to have the World Series game on, then how did you get a hold of a radio?
Well, at that time, the war was so close to being near the end that you could use radios. We could use the radio. We had wide room radios. We could get a global type of a connection on the radio. I remember I turned on the stinking radio in the wide room, and the St. Louis Cardinals are now playing the, I don't know who it was, and Blick Donley is the pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals. I could have died. And of course, the next spring was when we went to the game when St. Louis was playing Boston, you see.
There you were.
And there, and so Blix and I had we had him aboard ship for dinner, and the captain and the exec, everybody was highly impressed. You know?
Oh, I'm sure.
But anyway,
now, how was it that you ended up in Boston? You said you'd suffered some damage. How did it happen there?
It wasn't that time. We didn't have any casualties from any military action, but we ran into a typhoon coming back to the States, and that we really took a beating in the typhoon. And if I can digress a little bit, I'll tell you what happened. In that typhoon, I didn't think we'd survive, and this will help me God. But the captain, when we had a good captain, you headed right into the waves, and the ship would go up and down, and up and down, and up and down. And but if you'd get the waves or the wind from on the side of the ship, it would roll you over for a damn time, sure. But the captain knew what to do. And while we were fighting that typhoon, there were times when I thought that we are not going to come up anymore.
You were on a destroyer.
Yeah.
This was a large ship, wasn't it?
Well, when you run into a typhoon, a destroyer is a very small ship. It was really tossed about top.
Yeah.
And one of the boys aboard at the height of the storm, sometimes we would be covered with water, but by then the wave would pass and the ship would come out again. And one of the boys knelt down, grabbed a hold of a stanchion and started praying. The captain says, "What the goddamn hell do you think you're doing?" And the kid says, "I'm praying to Jesus Christ, the Son of God, to come down here and save us." The captain says, "Well, goddammit, if you're going to pray to anybody, bypass that kid Jesus and pray to the old man himself." And in a half an hour, that damn ocean was like this floor. And the captain was really shook. Holy smokes, he said. The storm abated and the sea was just like glass. And so we went down to the wine room and the captain trying to drink his coffee, and the cup was shaking, his head clicked against the saucer, you know. And the captain says, "Bernie, was mine a prayer?" And I said, "Well, goddammit, bypass that kid Jesus and pray to the old man himself." "Captain," I said, "that was an arrow prayer. You bypass that kid Jesus and you shot the old man right in the butt with your prayer." And this is why we had such a calm all of a sudden. The captain from then on was a changed man. I could never believe it. Yeah, he really changed. That did it to him. And he really became before that he said he was an agnostic. And then he said, "Ernie, I ain't a believer. I am a believer." "Yeah," he said, "but I had a bypass that kid Jesus." And he says, "Ernie, that was sin the way you said to you. Bypass that kid Jesus and you shot the old man right in the butt up there in heaven." And
got his attention.
The captain and I had the same captain 4 years. Every time he got transferred to another destroyer, I would be asked to go with him. So I am the last one I was on was the USS Hanson.
And which one was this on when the the typhoon that, was that
Jewish, that was the Jewish. That wasn't. I don't think I have a picture of that one. No, this was the. I think this was the Hanson. But anyway.
Yeah, that says Jewett on there.
That's the Jewett. That's the one that survived the typhoon.
Oh, that's a great looking ship.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
We had 400.
Double gun turrets in the front.
We had four twin mounts, 4-inch mounts, and then we had I don't know how many 40 millimeter, and then we had 20 millimeter guns and whatnot. Yeah, we were well armed. We had four torpedo tubes, and. But anyway, the war ended by then, and I went aboard, I was transferred from the Jewett onto the USS Hanson, and the Hanson was named after a Minneapolis boy that was killed in the invasion of, I think it was in the Midway battle. He was one of the pilots that lost his life. When the United States fleet sunk 4 Jap aircraft carriers in the span of 2 hours. And we knew that the war is going to be over now. No nation survives 4 aircraft sinkings. And
that did it.
And we all felt good about that. Now the war will be over. And anyway, I was transferred from the Jewett onto the Hanson. It was being built in Bath, Maine. The Hanson was being built in Bath, Maine. And I, as a chief engineering officer, was assigned to the ship about 6 weeks before it was launched. And I could supervise, or I could criticize anything that was done. If I felt that the workmen were not following proper rules and regulations in installing the turbines operated at 850 degrees of superheated steam. And I'll just tell you this one thing. I bitched when the workmen you wanted to pull the flanges of two steam pipes together with a block and tackle tube and then put in the bolts and to hold that together, you know. Well, with 850 degrees of superheated steam, and if there would be any stress, that pipe is going to give. Then I had a right to say no. You've got to make a pipe that's going to fit without any stress here. And anyway, the Hanson was launched, and I was the only officer there.
And what was your title at the time?
I was a full lieutenant. I was a senior grade lieutenant, and I was the chief engineering officer, so the captain wanted me there ahead of time to see how everything was being put in.
Yep.
Well, the ship was launched.
So you were really the very first one.
I was
this brand new ship.
Brand new ship, and until the captain arrived, I was the captain. I was a senior officer.
Out of Bath, Maine, the Bath ship was.
Yeah, that's what they call the SOPA, Senior Officer President of Florida. But let me tell you, when that ship was christened and it was launched, the building company, building company had a party in Bath, Maine, a full dress party for the builders of the ship, the owners or whatever, you know. I thought here I was a senior grade lieutenant and I had 4 battle stars on my ribbons and I thought I'd be highly accepted. So I went to the christening celebration. No, you can't come in. Well, why the hell not? I'm the senior officer present here now, and I'm going to be on the ship when we go out and fight the Japs. He says, your name is not in the blue book. You sons of bitches. My name was not in the blue book, and they would not let me attend the christening party. You wouldn't believe it, but that was my first aid. There is a division. There is a social division. We're being categorized. And, well, I figured, so okay, you not know the bastards. I thought to myself, no, I didn't
say it. I would have thought.
But anyway, the war ended and I went back to med school, and Mikhail, my friend from Lake City, he never forgot me. When he found out that I had a real bad heart, he looked me up right away and he said, Lefty, apparently they tell me you'll have to quit medical school because your heart is so bad. and that you're going to die if you stay in med school pitching ball and pitching ball besides. Well, I said, Mr. McHale, I already signed a contract with Faribault. 2 games a week. And I went to see Dr. I forget the name of the doctor who checked my heart out and everything. He said, Lefty, you can never pitch any more baseball. Your heart won't take it.
Was this at the University of Minnesota?
Minnesota. I was readmitted into the freshman class. And I told him I have already signed a contract and I'm going to honor that contract. And his name was, I can't think of his name, the doctor. But he told me, you will never make it. You're going to die on the mound.
How old were you at this point?
I must have been about 29 or 30 years old then.
Okay.
So I pitched 2 games a week all summer for Faribault. And I had a damn good season. My first game was against Frank Nessa. He was pitching for Owatonna. And God, I said, Frank, what the hell is going on over here? We beat them. And he never hit no home run off of me. And he had Max Moloch on his team. I don't know if you ever heard of Max Moloch.
He might have mentioned him. It's sort of familiar, actually.
Oh, Max was on the Owatonna team. Max, I said, do I have to pitch against you? He was third base for us when I was in Lake City. He, to me, Max was at least a triple-A ball player.
Wow.
He was the coach and the superintendent and everything in Winona, you know.
Oh, wow. So he was from Winona.
He was from Winona, and he was the big shot in Winona. But what a man and what a ball player. Gentleman, Lefty, he says, you and I are against each other now. But he said, you try to get me out, and I'll try to hit you. He got 2 doubles off of me, but he didn't get any home runs. And we beat Owatonna 8-2, and damn, I was real happy about that.
Yeah.
And well, I pitched all summer for Faribault. Fleckenstein was the manager and the owner. He owned the brewery too.
Well, I was just going to say, he's the man who owned the brewery. I know Fleckenstein's name.
He owned the brewery, and
sure.
Besides, I got $75 a game. But besides my regular pay, he always gave me a tip of $20 or $50.
You had it made. Working for a team that had a brewery connected to it? I don't know if you were ever a beer drinker.
Well, I tell you what happened. After the game, after the Owatonna game, Fleckenstein was so happy that we beat. I don't know what he called it. He had a name for him. So he had a special room in his brewery cut into the sand hill where there was a spigot sticking out of the sand and a nice cold beer. But there were 2 candy bars and 2 bottles of pop there. And here we were after the game, the whole team happier than hell. And I asked Rudy Fleckenstein, what's the pop for and what's the candy bar? They tell me you don't smoke, drink, you don't chase women. And so we got the pop and the candy bars for you. Put that stuff aside and give me that beer mug. I'm down. So they had copper beer mugs. And the beer came out of that out of the spigot, out of the sand. And as soon as you filled it with beer, the moisture was condensed on the ice. The best damn beer I ever drank in all my life. But so I pitched for Faribault all year long. And we didn't win. They had some good ball players in that stinking league. Albert Lee had a real good team. Some of my former teammates from Duluth and Crookston were with Wasika and Mankato and all the Moose Cowan was first base for Austin in that league at that time. Moose Cowan went from Austin to the New York Yankees.
Yeah.
He played for the New York Yankees, I don't know for how long. But Moose was a hothead. He didn't like to be struck out. And one time I struck him out. And he took that ball and he threw it over the grandstand and he lost it. But he was that kind of a fellow. He was a hothead.
Oh my gosh, a friend of mine just met Moose Cowan.
Recently?
Yeah, about a year ago, because Cowan is big into horses now.
Oh,
into horse racing. And my friend Pete Christensen he's also a big, and they met at a Chicago racetrack where they were having a celebration, and he was telling me about this last April. So it's funny you should bring up Scouter.
Oh, Moose was, he didn't like to be struck out, and he was a left-hand hitter. I pitched him inside and tight, and if he didn't go after them, I had good enough control of my dead fish. I thrown that palm ball and just barely get up. And one time, Moose Garland, I think it was Moose Lucky, you throw that goddamn change at me, and I see it coming. And I see it coming, and then I come a little bit, and then I don't have any power, and I can't hit it. But Tom Sheehan told me I had the best changeup that he had ever seen.
Mm.
It was really and I could control it. I could float it over those corners.
Mm.
Otherwise, I couldn't have pitched for forever with a bad heart.
Mm-hmm.
But they asked me, why don't you warm up more? I couldn't. If I would use up my energies warming up, I didn't have energy to pitch the 9 innings.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have, you didn't have to warm up for a changeup.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I was, my control was good enough. I wasted my fastball just on the outside and just on the inside. And I came in there with the dead fish right down the middle. And
oh,
they're swinging the river.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And yeah, Tom Sheehan was the manager. He said, Lefty, as long as you pitch, never lose faith in your change.
Uh-huh.
You got the best one that there is. And Tom Sheehan, the Minneapolis manager, asked me, Lefty, where did you learn about that changeup? When I was about 10 or 11 years of age, I wrote letters to Carl Hubble and to Lefty Grove and to I can't think of the name of the other fellow that I wrote in the big league. They all answered me. And the slow ball pitcher was the one that really emphasized, learn to control your changeup, and you can pitch it easily. And Carl Hubble told me how to throw it, and he sent me a nice little booklet how to, the screwball is a very good pitch for a left-hander. Learn how to throw that.
Mm.
Yeah, always into the left-hand hitter.
Oh.
And Lefty Grove emphasized control. Be sure you've got good control. Huh? Yeah. And so, but this helped to have that kind of a back, you know.
Yeah, I guess that would have inspired you.
I sure did, yeah. Because before I started high school, when I was, I was 19 when I started high school. And I was working for a farmer north of Holdingford for $15 a month.
North of where?
North of Holdingford, Minnesota. Holdingford. They were in a great Sioux League at then. And this was 1929, and jobs were hard to find. And I was getting $15 a month for, and I from 5 in the morning till about 8 or 9 at night. 40 cows, and I had to feed them. And
milk them by hand, I suppose.
I milked the 14 cows by hand, morning and night. And I worked there a whole year. I worked there a whole year, and at the end of the year, I asked him for $17.50 a month. He wouldn't give it to me. Well, I said, well, if I can't get $17.50 a month, I'll quit. Well, what can you do? He said. I said, well, I would like to play professional ball. My ambition would be to go to high school. Well, Otto Stein, my boss, told me, you're too old for high school, 19, and you're too short for baseball for you to make the big leagues. That would be just like peeing into a 40-mile-an-hour wind, he said.
Now, come on.
Damn right. And I said, you son of a bitch, I'll show you. And so I quit.
Geez, he didn't know much.
He was a state representative, and he was the head honcho of Holdingford. He was the head of the school board, and he was the head of the church board, and he was the head of everything.
Gee, they take that back.
And I said, I'll show you. And
but there were very, very famous major leaguers who were 5'5" tall, who were very successful pitchers.
Well, I tell you what his problem was. He had 5 sons. And they were all 6-footers, and as handsome as you are. And 3 of them were doctors, 1 was in the Secret Service, and 1 was in One was at the University of Minnesota, or at that time he may have been at St. John's yet, but he was going to be an attorney. So all of his sons ended up being very prestigious people.
Okay.
And so I quit, and he wouldn't give me $17.50 a month. And I got hurt when he told me that for me to try to make the big leagues would be like peeing into a 40-mile-an-hour window. And
excuse me for laughing. It's just unusual to hear anyone describe a situation like that.
Yeah, he said, now, if you would be like my son, Kent, then you'd have a chance, because you were about 6'4", you see. But you were 5'8", and, you know, and you're too old for high school. Well, hell, I was sitting on my stinking suitcase along the roadside, and Norbert Nywert come along. He was renting a farm from his mother on the west of Bolingport. Stein was north. He picked me up. He said, well, Lefty, what are you doing here sitting on a suitcase? And I said, well, I just got fired. I wanted $17.50 a month, and he wouldn't give it to me, so I got canned. And Norton Howard said, put your suitcase in my car, come home with me. I'm renting a farm from my mother, and I'll give you $30 a month. So I went with Norton Howard to his place, and I June, July, and August, and about two weeks before high school started, I told Norbert, my boss, he was about 24, 25, Norbert, I envied you that you have a high school education and all that, and I would give anything to go to high school, but here I am 19 years of age and I can't do it anymore. The hell you can't, he says. That night, he had me over to Holdingford and he introduced me to the superintendent, and he says, at 19, and the superintendent says, well, I'll guarantee you, you won't be the youngest freshman, and you won't be the handsomest one, but I'll guarantee you, you'll be the oldest one.
Hey, not a bad prestige to have, I mean, you know,
and so
everybody would know you then.
And, I started high school, and by now, Ado Ernst was the superintendent. He made out a 3-year course for me so I could finish in 3 years.
Oh my.
Yeah, I took 16 credits in 3 years, and I played football the first 2 years. Mm. But the next year, if you're over 20, you can't play football. But I didn't care. But while I was in Holdingford, I was pitching. I ball for the Holdingford team. Lefty Abnett, you must have heard of him. Ambrose Abnett. Lefty Abnett was the Holdingford pitcher before I came.
Yeah.
And one time, when I was working for Norbert Nywert, the farmer that got me to go into high school, we had a Bush League team then. Norbert and I, he was the catcher and I was the pitcher, and we picked up 8, 10, 12 other farm boys, and we had a Bush League team, and we played the Bushwhackers and Bolos and Wildon and the smaller teams that weren't as good as Holdingford. And one time, we played an exhibition game against Holdingford. We challenged the great Sioux Leaguers. And Lefty Abnett was pitching for Holdingford at that time, just before he went into to pitch for Winnipeg. And I pitched for the Bushwhackers. We beat them. And when school started, Lefty had already signed the contract with Winnipeg.
Oh, okay.
So he went to with the Winnipeg Maroons, and yeah. I took his place as the first string pitcher for Holdingford. And I pitched for Holdingford when my sophomore year in high school, we were doing real well. Oh, damn. By that time, I had mastered what Lefty Grove had to say and what
Hubble.
Hubble, and then the
Stobo. There's one other guy, huh?
I think his name was Moss or something. But that slow ball intrigued me. Hot damn. Oh boy, you throw it with the pop. And it's just very close to me. The hitter was selected. You throw that shitty shit ball at me. And who the hell can I get that?
What did they call it?
Shit ball.
Right. That's because they didn't have any defense against it.
But they, and Wally Gilbert, when I was a sophomore in high school when Minneapolis picked me up and they sent me to Duluth in the Northern League. Wally Gilbert was the third baseman for Duluth in the Northern League, and he was a former Brooklyn Dodger.
Mm.
And he played third base for Duluth at that time when I signed up for Duluth. Mike Kelly sent me out there. And he pitched those games for me. He told me how to pitch every hitter from third base. He left keep your fastball. It's not very fast, but keep it on the inside or outside. He's an outside ball hitter. But make him hit that dead fish.
So what did he do? Come in from third base and have a little conference with you on the mound?
Every hitter, he told me how to pitch.
And he'd cover up his mouth with his glove?
This one can't. He won't hit your dead fish. Then Wally was quite the man. He and I got along.
Uh-huh.
And I won, I guess, I don't know, my first year in the Northern League, even though what Blix Donnelly told me, lefty, this is not college ball. He said, they'll hit the well, yeah, it wasn't college ball. But there was a fellow who was pitching for Hamlin when I was at St. John's, Buzz Gray. He met me at the hotel, Metropole.
Yeah, I read his name, yeah.
Lefty. Push it over. We had four bats, and three of them were nailed and taped together. And that was the whole thing. And the manager was open-eyed, and he was drunk, and I was amazed.
And this is Duluth?
Duluth.
And what was the name of this manager?
Obergard. Ray Obergard.
Okay. Ray Obergard.
Yeah, but he was a nice man, but his alcohol was his problem. I don't know why. And we had some, Blix Donnelly was, during the war, Blix Donnelly was drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals. And then we had, but that's beside the point.
About Mike Kelly and his $5,000 bonus promise.
You had nothing on paper. And so after the season ended, every year they recalled me to Minneapolis. But every year, it was the same thing. Well, you don't have anything right. He never gave it to me. But in the long leap forward, after I was with Moline before the war began, and towards the end of my stay at Moline, I knew that McHale told me, Lefty, there is going to be a war, and you better we'll get you into the Navy. I don't want you to go into the Army. So when the Moline Plows, we were way down at the bottom. We didn't have any really, we didn't win very many ball games. Rush Rollinson was with us, and we had, Schroeder was with us. We had some good ball players, but the 3I League, Warren Spahn was with Evansville.
Yeah.
And then Warren Spahn, I opposed him about three times during the summer, and he and I would have dinner together. He said, Lefty, you've got just as good a stuff as I have, but he says, I can control my pitches better than you can. Work on control, and I'll guarantee you, you'll make the big leagues. Warren Spahn told me that.
My gosh.
God, what a man.
Well, you know what? I got to find Warren Spahn's phone number for you. Wouldn't you love to give him a call and say, you know who this is?
I really would. He was the one that told me, work on control. You've got good stuff, but work on control. And the Lefty, he said, you don't have any good backing. I tell you, I hate to tell you this. We had a catcher from Chicago on the moving team. And I wondered, come on, have such a hard time getting these people out. And I won't mention his name, but there was a fellow on the Minneapolis Winners Ball Club who was from Chicago. He called me after my stint with Duluth, with Moline, just before the war began. He called me and said, Lefty, do you know that your catcher for Moline was telling all of the Chicago hitters on all the other teams what you were throwing? No damn wonder we couldn't win the damn.
Oh my gosh, who was that?
No, I'm not going to mention that.
Oh man.
He was a traitor.
I can't believe that guys did that even back then.
I got a call from a fellow who trusted me, and he was with the Minneapolis Millers. He said, Lefty, I want to tell you another thing. He says, you already have been assigned to another ball club. You won't even be considered for a regular pitching job with Minneapolis next year. But I want to tell you that you are not considered yet. That they were so loaded with Harry Smythe and Wally Tauscher and Bellaby Bean and Mickey Hafner and, Hogsett.
Okay.
Elon Hogsett. They had a tremendous pitching staff. He said, they don't have room for you. So you're going to be farmed out again. But then he told me, if you want to know why you had such a hard time with Moline, your catcher was killing all the Chicago boys on all the other teams, the Cedar Rapids and Decatur. He was telling them what's coming. No wonder we couldn't win. We didn't win very many ball games.
Man, wouldn't you think the manager, Moline manager, would pick up on that?
Well,
maybe they were in it together.
I don't think so. I think that this he had his buddies from Chicago and Moline were out of it, and so. But a lot of the other boys that he knew from Chicago were getting into the big leagues would depend upon how well they did in the three-I league, you see? So everybody wanted to get into the big leagues, no question about it.
And they had their friend over here who was giving all the tips
and
helping them along.
A fellow called me and he said, but don't ever quote my name, I don't want, but I thought I'd tell you that your name, you're not going to be with the Millers next year. You are going to be farmed out again. And then
this wasn't the same catcher.
Otto Denning was good.
Okay.
Otto Denning was the catcher for the
Millers.
He was true blue. He was solid.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a very righteous man, and I loved him for it. But anyway, December 7th come along, and so. December 7th came along, and McCahill, my benefactor from Lake City, called me and said, Lefty, you don't belong in the Army. Now, we will get you into the Navy. And my local board was St. Cloud, Minnesota, and I was already in med school. And December 7th, I was September when the 3I League ended. I went back to med school, and I was a freshman in med school when the war broke out. And they disregarded my being in med school, and my local board in St. Cloud first told me that if I would get letters from three of my professors and the dean of the medical school, they would defer me. I had those three letters and from the dean, and I gave them to my local draft board, and about a week later, I got a letter when I was at TU, and I figured, well, hell, this is just telling me that I was deferred. I threw the letter into the desk drawer. A month later, this was September when school started again. In November, I opened the letter, and here I was supposed to be in a training camp in Kentucky someplace. They denied my request
for deferment?
My local board. And so I went to St. Cloud. I said, what the hell? You people told me I was going to get deferred and not. Well, they all had the same story. I had to go when World War I was on, and I went and risked my neck. And next fellow says he was in World War I and he did this. And the third member of the board said he was in World War I and he did. So we thought you should go too. So I went. Mikhail didn't help me, but I got into the midshipman training on the USS Prairie State in New York. It was an old battleship anchored, and there were 507 of us.
And it was called the USS Prairie?
Prairie State. It was a battleship, Illinois. And they were the training ship for midshipman training. And I was one of 507 midshipmen in that class. 3 months, we were put through the ropes all of a sudden to become naval officers, you know. And I survived those 3 months. Yeah, but we had tests every day. And my big problem was, we had to do drill deck marching, 60 of us. And they gave very fast order by their left flank march, by the right flank march, to the rear march, forward march. And I didn't know that I was dyslexic. I didn't know my right foot when he put orders. And they stopped the marching. They said, you're going to kill somebody. You see, but to the rear march, and I would go against what the
I couldn't make it fast enough.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and, it just wasn't processing quickly enough.
I didn't know. So the doctor who was on the ship at the Prairie State had a one-hour interview with me. And I told him, yes, I'm a left-hander. But when I was in the fifth grade, the teacher changed me. She worked on me like hell until I learned how to write right-handed. And he said, that was a mistake they made. You, to this day, you will always have trouble making quick. Your mind, you are dyslexic. He said, right from left, you won't be your mind because you will change. They mixed up your blueprints inside of your head. But they let me stay in the Navy.
Because you were a natural lefty.
I was a natural
and,
lefty.
And if you would have just been left alone, then you would have been, everything would have been okay.
Everything would have been okay. But I, to this day, I have to write right-handed. And when I write right-handed, I want to write something quick. That I don't want to, you get a thought, idea you get, you want to write it down quick. I pick the pen up with my left hand every time. And but
instinct.
Instinct, yeah. And then I have to shift it to my right hand.
Oh,
but,
man.
Anyway,
that must be incredibly frustrating.
But anyway, I didn't have to drill that much, but they didn't bilge me out. They said, Lefty, this is not your fault. You are a converted left-hander, and this is why you're having fun. You won't be endangering anybody when you're an officer, because they don't have any close order drills anymore.
Okay.
So I was excused from doing close order drills on the USS Prairie State, and when we graduated, there were 507 of us graduated. We became ensigns. The fellow on my right here, I don't know his name, and the fellow on my left here, I don't know his name, but they were sons of very wealthy people. This fellow on my left, his dad was a U.S. senator, and this fellow on my left was, his dad was a owner of a big manufacturing firm in New York someplace. They never talked to me, but they talked over me for the 3 months. Well, we were commissioned officers at 9 o'clock in the morning, and right after we were commissioned, we were assigned our duties. The war was on full blast then, after Pearl Harbor, and I was assigned to the USS Juno. J-U-N-E-A-U. This fellow on my right was assigned to the USS Jewett, an old destroyer. And he immediately told me, you will get a telegram. In 15 minutes, you will be changed. I will take his place on the old destroyer, Jewett. And he said, I'll take your place on the brand new cruiser, the Juno. 15 minutes later, I got the telegram. Your assignment has been changed. You will be reassigned to the USS Jewett, and this fellow went on the USS Juno.
Which was bound for where? Where was that going to be headed for?
I didn't know where the Jewett was or where the Juno was. But 3 months later, I was on my USS Jewett chasing submarines and convoying ships and the like. And when we got the ONI bulletin, USS Juno was sunk in the Battle of the Java Sea with 7 survivors out of 750 men. That man saved my life.
7 survivors.
7 survivors out of 750 men. The Japanese, 2 battleships and a cruiser, got the Juno in a, she steamed, and they were steaming single file. So all of their guns could bear on the Juno. And the Juno was steaming right into a death trap. She lasted 7 minutes when they opened up the compartment. They just melted her away.
Damn.
2 battleships and a couple of cruisers and one of them, they didn't have a chance.
So if they were in the Java Sea, they were in them trying to figure out exactly which land body they were near. Were they in the near the Philippines?
It was pretty much a little bit south of the Philippines, yeah. I don't know. I couldn't tell you for sure where they were.
Well, I'll look it up on the map.
But anyway, the Juno went down with 7 survivors. A U.S. senator saved my life when he had his son take
my place of the Juno, and I took the place of his son and the Jewett, and hell, we survived this stinking war.
It's incredible. Well, who was this man? You ever remember his name?
I don't remember. He wouldn't talk to me. See, they were aristocrats. I was a farm boy. I had manure on my shoes yet. I spoke with an accent, and they were aristocrats. Yeah.
Speaking of your accents, what accent is it? What nationality are you?
I'm Polish.
Okay.
And my grandmother always told me, you can work your way out of situations, but don't let them throw you. But anyway, that's another story. But then when I was aboard the USS Jewett, the destroyer, and I had the same captain all the way through. After I was transferred from the Jewett, they always kept putting new ships. Uh-huh. And I was assigned to the USS Hanson. First, I was assigned to a ship that was being built in Orange, Texas. But before I got to Orange, Texas, I got my orders. My orders were changed, and I was to go to Back, Maine, and I will be the chief engineering officer and the senior watch officer on the USS Hanson. I knew what happened. My captain got transferred off to Jewett, and he was assigned to the Hanson.
Oh.
I knew right away what the hell happened. He was assigned as captain to the Hanson.
Well, that was a good thing.
He wanted me there, yeah. And so.
But you had decided at that time you weren't going to be going back to the Hanson. Did you do any time on the Hanson?
Oh, you don't... disobey order. I was going to go to Orange, Texas. The ship was being built there. I was on my way there on the train when I got my orders via telegram to turn around and go back to the back main shipyards where the Hanson was being built. You will be assigned to the USS Hanson.
Okay, so you were on your way from Boston to Texas?
Yeah.
And why were you driving to Texas?
I got the change of orders. I don't know what the name of the ship was that was being built in Orange, Texas.
Okay, so that was a whole nother new ship being built.
Okay. When the captain was transferred off of the Jewett, shortly after I was transferred to new shipbuilding, and he got the ship Hanson in Back, Maine.
Uh-huh.
He wanted me. So I was his chief engineering officer. And when I got there, the captain wasn't there yet, but my duties were to make sure that all of the engineering, the turbines and the generators and the everything was in my responsibility was electrical and the steam propulsion. That was that 60,000 horsepower plant was my responsibility, and the captain, the management of the Navy Yard told me, you have the power to disagree. Anything that you see being done here, as the ship is being finished, you can stop the work on it, and we have to obey you.
You had that kind of power, yet they still wouldn't let you into the party.
No. I had, but this was a governmental power. That came, and so, I bitched a little bit about a few little things that I didn't like.
Okay.
We're going to be sailing the ship, and we're going
to
be...
we know how to... When we're out at sea, what we need to be able to do.
We're going
to
use, it's my neck that's being risked, not the builder.
Right.
But they wouldn't have put me to the party. I didn't give a damn. But anyway, I was there about two or three weeks, and then the captain arrived. And then
what was his name, the captain?
Captain Parham, P-A-R-H-A-M.
Okay.
Very good name. Yeah, he was the one that bypassed that kid Jesus and shot the old man right in the butt.
Now, who was the one who was down grabbing the pole?
That was one. Seaman third class. He had just been aboard 3 or 4 months or so. He started praying. He was praying. The captain said, what the goddamn hell do you think you're doing over here? I'm praying to Jesus Christ, the Son of God, to come down here and say, well, God, some of you preach to anybody, bypass that kid Jesus and pray to the old man himself.
And lo and behold, in about 20 minutes or a half an hour, it was out of the woods.
Captain,
what a miracle, indeed.
The captain was drinking his coffee in the water, and then his hand was rattling.
Boy, he better be careful rattling his cup, jiggling the pipes. He could give away the position to the subs that are down.
But he said, Ernie, was mine a prayer? I said, Captain, yours was an arrow prayer. And the, you know...
An arrow prayer?
Arrow prayer. Uh-huh. A-R-R-O-W. Like, yeah, you bypass that kid, Jesus, and you shut your mouth.
No offense, but we need some quick action.
But everybody, man. We had a good time over it. And it really united our ship.
Now, you know, you had mentioned on the phone that every, it seemed that almost every ship had a ball team.
They sure did. This is another story. We'd be going into port in some of these foreign ports, and then a stupid one-time aircraft carrier. Hey, we got $10,000 that says you can't beat us in a game of baseball today. The captain picks up the bullhorn for him. Now, here it is. The sons of bitches on the aircraft carrier says they've got $10,000 that says we can't beat them in a game of baseball today. We accepted all challenges. We had some tremendous ball games out there. Hot damn.
Well, where did you play? Right on the aircraft carrier or on a ship?
We would be in port then.
Okay, okay.
Foreign ports, Iran, Africa, or
Morocco, maybe?
All
or?
These places. Every place had a ball field, and the people who were running it were people like Bob Feller or the professional ball players who went into the service, and they were the umpires. And they would run between the ships. There were baseball games going like hell.
Oh, my gosh.
And one time we were, I forget now, we were 10. And the captain said, now, Lefty, it's all up to you now. And, well, we had a good ball club. We had a good ball club. When you got 450 American boys aboard ship, you are going to have a good ball club.
It's quite a city, 450 men.
And every ship had a good ball club.
Wow.
But we never lost a money game. After one game, I got tipped $750.
Woo!
And the captain...
Little tip money there.
Captain will never forget. God bless him. Ah, damn, this is great.
We're glad we have you on our team.
And this is why when he was saying... Well, he wanted me on his hands, so he thought to just the team. But then, when, you know, ship was being built. But, we had fun. Those games, we fought tooth and nail, I'll tell you. And Mike Kelly was, by coincidence, our catcher was named Mike Kelly. And he, too, was a professional.
Oh,
he, too, was a professional when the war broke out. He was the gunnery officer, and I was the chief engineer officer. We never lost a money game in the Navy.
Mike Kelly catching after he had, well, now this would have been after your first year with the Millers, correct?
Yeah.
The first year you had with the Millers, that would have been 40.
This is Mike Kelly.
Oh, no kidding.
And this is the captain.
Oh, my.
This is the executive. Where am I? I don't know. I can't. But anyway, Mike Kelly was a tremendously good catcher.
Oh,
he
man.
Was a low ball catcher. And Lefty, make him hit that shit ball of yours.
Oh.
He thought that. He really thought. He says I was, in his books, I deserved to be a professional baseball player. I had good control, and and Mike Kelly was with me. He said, keep that change up of yours in the strike zone and make him hit that change or make him hit your pitching, make him hit your, you say your fastball isn't very fast. But keep it out of the strike zone by 4 or 6 inches or so. And they won't drive it. He said they'll dribble it.
Well, that's a good way to maintain morale.
We had a tremendous ship. We were together like you'd never believe. Our ship's force was united like you'd never believe. A fellow by the name of Myers played first base. Pat Jurek played left field. I don't remember all that. But we had Pat Jurek after the war. Was in the big leagues. Just a couple of years ago, he was still playing in one of the big league teams, Pat Jurek. But then I called him. And no, that's not Lefty. That's my son that's playing in the big leagues now.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Paciorek. P-A-C-I-O-R-E-K. Yeah.
Oh, that's how you say that.
Paciorek. Yeah.
Because I would have, I've heard that name pronounced Paciorek.
But maybe that's right.
Paciorek.
We call him Paciorek. He was a good boy. You know what amazed me about Shipboard baseball players? Those kids didn't know how to make an error. They come up with everything. Fly balls, ground balls, they come up with everything.
Isn't that amazing? But, you know, I was just, I was telling Frank how even when I was going to my first baseball games, which my dad took me to in Wrigley Field, and before the game, and you'd see the players warming up, they were so good. They were so careful. They were so slick. They never dropped anything. You know, and you go to a game today, and they're playing around out on the ball field like it's a schoolyard, dropping everything and throwing errantly, and it's just so different.
I was impressed with the of course, we didn't have who in civilian life was third baseman. Okay, you're third baseman. Who played first base? I was first base for Put On Junction. So this is how we made the team, you know. And Kelly was the catcher. Yeah, nobody's gonna take that catcher's job away from him.
Oh wow!
Yeah, he was the catcher. He said, "Lefty, you will be a success because you keep the ball low."
Mm.
And he says, "But you're not quite fast enough. But you got that changeup, and that changeup will win you ball game." And it really that you make a big change. No kidding. And that was. And but anyway. This was the war time, the war ended. And but then towards the end of the war was when we went to Boston, when Blix Donnelly was pitching for St. Louis Cardinals. And he the Cardinals were playing Boston. And Blix even suggested that if I could come back the next day, they would put a suit on me and I could pitch batting practice. I know he was, the manager of the Cardinals, fine. But we had to, our ship, I had to get underway the next day, so I couldn't.
Oh man! Well, you were about to pitch a lot of batting practice you had pitched a lot of batting practice for the Millers already.
I pitched batting practice for one whole summer after I graduated from St. John's.
Yeah, who do you remember from that team? That would have been that 39 team, wouldn't
you? You want me to tell you all of them?
Anyone you can remember?
Okay.
I want to ask you too about Mike Kelly because he's a very prominent figure in Minneapolis
but
baseball.
He wasn't drunk all the time.
Mike Kelly was.
He was drunk all the time. And he wasn't a man of his word. He didn't.
Well, see, that's no good.
Otto Denning told me about that. Don't pay any attention to what Mike tells you because he's unreliable. There was Otto Denning was the catcher, and Walter Tauscher was one of the pitchers. Bellevue Bean was one of the pitchers. Hodsett was a gentleman. Elon Hodsett was a pitcher. He was an Indian origin.
Yeah, because they had called him Chief.
Chief. Mm-hmm. One time we were playing Toledo, and Chief Hodson was pitching, and when Chief was pitching, Tom Sheehan would be telling the rookies and the dugout stories, and he would forget about the stupid ball game. And when he was telling us some stories, you know, he liked the talk and whatnot. He looked up, and there was, Minneapolis was ahead, he had 5-2. But Toledo had filled the bases. And all of a sudden, Tom Sheehan woke up. Hey, Chief, what the calm down hell there is that you're doing up there? Chasing the wolves up in the big woods? And, but to make a long story short, they won that ball game. And my last year in baseball, I signed a contract with Crooks and with Bloomer in the Western Mini League.
Okay.
Chief Elon Hodson was pitching for Clara City.
Oh my gosh, now where's Clara City?
Clara City was just south of Wilmer.
Oh, okay.
They were in the same league. Clara City, Wilmer, Benson.
Was Waverly in there?
No, Waverly was in the right county.
Okay.
The Waverly wasn't as tough for me.
Okay.
Western Mini? Western Mini was pretty tough. You had a bear down.
I'm surprised that league's not in my book. Actually, I'm not even sure if it isn't. But if that would have been 1941?
No, let me see.
A little later than that?
No,
or even earlier?
Look now here. War ended in 1945, and I pitched for Fairmont in 1945, and did for, wait a minute, it was 44 or 45, and I was with Fairwell my freshman year, and then I was with Weaverly my sophomore year in med school, and then my junior year I was with Wilmer. Yeah, I pitched for Wilmer. Ike Vanguard was the manager for Wilmer. Nice man. Yeah, lefty. And I didn't warm up or I didn't get into shape or anything when the season opened with Ben was Wilmer. And I went there to watch the ball game, the first game. Vanguard, the manager, called me and told me, well, lefty, come here just to watch the game. They were playing Benson. And yeah, okay. So I went out to Wilmer and Art Vanguard, manager, had me at his home. And Art says, hey, Bonnie was his wife's name. Do we have a left-handed glove around here someplace? Maybe lefty could just warm up a little bit. And then Art Vanguard says, hey, Bonnie, isn't there an old pair of shoes around here, baseball shoes? And I sized. Lefty, what size do you wear? They brought out the pair of shoes. Then I smelled a rat. That was the pitcher's toe plate was on the for the left-handed. And there was already a new pitcher's toe plate on that pair of shoes. And then they had a glove that fit me. And then, Bonnie, is there a uniform around here or something that might fit him? So it was a regular Wilmer baseball suit. So I put on the suits and Art says, we'll maybe have your coach third base or something. And 15 minutes before the game started, Art Vanguard, the manager, gave a speech to the boys. And then he didn't look at me, but he threw the ball my way. And lefty will pitch you a good ball game, but back him up. Holy balls, and I hadn't thrown a baseball all week. Not once. And we played Benson. 2-1, 13 innings. We beat them 2-1.
And how many innings did you pitch?
13. But I couldn't scratch my head for a week after.
Oh, man.
But I wonder if I got my scrapbook here. I tell you, I gave him three singles. And Ellefson was my catcher. And I told Ellefson that before the game, I said, LD was his first name. I said, I am a funny pitcher. I'll be free, and my change up will come in there.